Chapter 1. Dark Forces. A minister today, a banker tomorrow, a banker today, a minister tomorrow. A handful of bankers, who have the whole world in their grip, are making a fortune out of the war. V.I. Lenin. In March 1916, a British officer called Samuel Hoare set out for Russia. The last thing he was thinking about was revolutionary socialism. If anybody had asked, he would probably have muttered that he wanted to be soldiering. When war with Germany had broken out, he had been among the first to sign up with the Norfolk Yeomanry. But his physical frailty had ruled out active service in combat. Instead, at 36, he had been recruited by Sir Mansfield Smith Cumming, the legendary C, to work for the British Secret Intelligence Service in the Russian capital Petrograd. While other members of his class were in the trenches, he mastered espionage, censorship, and ciphering. He probably experimented with disguises, too. His new boss was addicted to them, and had his own, designed by William Berry Clarkson's theatrical shop in Soho's Wardour Street. The task that Hoare had been assigned was intricate. He had to find out if his country's Russian allies were maintaining their side of a wartime anti-German trade embargo. The British were particularly keen on this. They hoped to move into the Russian market when the war was won. In the meantime, there were also fears that the remaining commercial links between Russia and Germany might serve as cover for spying, and possibly for sabotage. As he worked with Russia's haphazard Restriction of Enemy Supplies Committee, Hoare would have to monitor the patterns of Russia's import trade, the merchants, markets, and any complaints of shortages. His other mission in the Russian capital was to take a close and critical look at the operation of the British intelligence mission. Though this might feel like military stuff, he was supposed to keep in mind the business angle even here. As Frank Stagg, the man who ran the Russia desk in London, explained to Hoare before he left, a firm footing in Russia might produce sufficient information to serve up some tempting dishes not merely to the British government, but to the big financial and commercial interests in the city. It was a job that called for tact. For one thing, the French were the people with the real Russian expertise. For decades now, Frenchmen had been established at the Tsarist court as trading and investment partners, as well as arbiters of fashion and suppliers of champagne. French officers had all the best contacts inside the Russian secret services. To some extent, this was a help, for Britain and France were allies, yoked to each other and to Russia through a treaty system called the Triple Entente. But by 1916, their understanding was no longer quite enough. When the day came for British exporters to move into a post-war Tsarist empire after all, those same Frenchmen would represent the competition. More immediately, C had a string of problems in Russia. There had been tensions from the first, between his agents and Colonel Alfred Knox, the British military attaché, while the officer whom C had initially entrusted with the Russian show, Major Archibald Campbell, had recently been recalled after a storm of complaints. To cap it all, the ambassador, Sir George Buchanan, was old school and stiff upper lip, the kind who disliked covert operations on principle. Difficulties had arisen, as Hoare put it, because of interdepartmental disputes as to the exact place the Secret Service should hold in the official hierarchy. The phrase was English understatement at its best. As a member of Parliament and a baronet, Hoare was the man to sort things out. The new spy had to make his own way to the posting. Hoare had a berth reserved from Newcastle on a Norwegian steamer called the Jupiter. Among the other passengers, huddled in the fog like so many exotic birds, was a party of French dressmakers bound for Russia with their suite of fashion models. Theirs was a risky business, for the seaway was a magnet for German submarines. As the Jupiter steamed out of the Tyne, everyone took to scanning the waves. The crossing was uneventful on this occasion, however, and Hoare disembarked safely at the port of Bergen, among the grey officials and the businessmen, the smugglers and the mannequins. From here, the journey continued to Christiania, Oslo, the capital of Norway, and on by sleeper to Stockholm. Hoare had to cross the Scandinavian countries in mufti, concealing my sword in an umbrella case. As an officer in the service of a belligerent power, he would have been liable for internment if he'd been caught by the police in neutral Sweden. That was the theory, anyway. In fact, he found that Sweden swarmed with spies, although it seemed to welcome only German ones. When he paid a visit to Sir Esme Howard, the British ambassador in Stockholm, Hoare learned how volatile the mood in Sweden had become. The ban on war-related trade with Germany had hit it hard. Food and jobs had come under pressure, as British naval ships began to claim the right to control the cargo of neutrals, as well as that of belligerents. Children were going without medicines, businessmen without their checks, and traders without markets for their timber, grain, and iron. A large section of Sweden's ruling elite was sympathetic to the idea of a pact, even an alliance with Germany. The Baltic, after all, united the two countries far more than it divided them. When he dropped into Stockholm's Grand Hotel, Hoare hung his fur coat on a peg and was amused to watch a German agent scuttle out to rifle through the pocket straight away. He came to need that fur coat more and more as he went north. From Stockholm, he headed into Sweden's more remote Norrland, a wilderness that Sami hunters shared with elk and Arctic fox and bear. As the writer Arthur Ransome had put it when he traversed the same route, the whole thing promises to be interesting but cold. Hoare was the MP for Chelsea, however, and he travelled first class for the whole route. "The ride," he wrote, "was peaceful and monotonous. At one point the train could not have gone more than 5 miles an hour, and ample time was allowed for the excellent hot dishes at the appointed stations." One of those stops, nearly 600 miles north of Stockholm, was the Bothnian port of Luleå, whose docks were used to load the iron ore from mines at Kiruna and Gällivare. The previous autumn, as Hoare knew, the British submarine commander, Captain Cromie, had sunk a large number of Swedish ships just off this port, all carrying blockade-breaking cargoes of iron for Germany, thousands of tons of it in every hold. The region was an awkward place for any British officer, and Hoare was heading for its wildest town. No pre-war timetable would mark his route, for no line had existed here before the summer of 1915. Arthur Ransome, who made his way to Russia when the railway still ended at Karungi, recalled that the last miles in Sweden had involved a sledge journey in the short light of winter, lying flat on a sledge, kept warm by a lap driver who kindly sat on my stomach as we hissed over the snow track and down a frozen river to the Finnish frontier at Tornio. 15 months later, Samuel Hoare could breathe in relative comfort as his train crept forward between walls of blackened snow, the skeletons of trees just visible beyond the steam. The final miles were signalled by the appearance of countless wooden crates, huge piles every stop. Then came the reindeer sledges and the grizzled men in city coats. Hoare had arrived at Haparanda, the frontier town that controlled the crucial land route from Europe to Russia and onwards to Shanghai. He did not pause to see the sights. He could have explored the frozen marshes, where boxed-up freight from the United States and Britain, Denmark, France, and Sweden itself had been piled in makeshift streets and courtyards like a second town. He could have dropped into a local bar. There, watching the off-duty fishermen and reindeer drivers, he could have picked up news from three continents at once. A few months later, a Russian politician called Paul Milyukov, who passed through Haparanda in the opposite direction on an official trip to London, took pictures of the midnight sun there with his Kodak camera. A revolutionary activist called Alexander Shlapnikov, who crossed the border so often that he knew every safe house for a radius of miles, would marvel at the northern lights in winter skies. But Hoare, a true-born Englishman, was most struck by the weather. "Everything was dazzling white under the blazing sun," he recalled. The snow had not a stain upon it, and the white sheepskin caps of the Swedish garrison looked yellow in the glare. The Russian border post at Tornio felt bleak after Haparanda. Most new arrivals spent a long time sitting in the huts that served as checkpoints for the Tsarist border guards. Hall was travelling to Russia on official business, and an undercover agent of British intelligence was almost certainly on hand. But C's new spy could not afford to draw attention to himself by pulling rank. After several trying encounters of his own, Arthur Ransom had learnt to flourish a letter on heavily embossed paper, and though it was in fact a demand for the return of overdue books to the London Library, the signature of the librarian, Dr. Charles Theodore Hagberg Wright, was so flamboyant that it reduced even the sternest bureaucrat to unctuous civility. Lacking Ransom's resourcefulness, most other travellers recalled the inside of the border buildings with a shudder. Hall's wait was so long that a group of Russian soldiers broke into a dance, hoping to screw some small change from their audience. It felt like a whole season of his life had passed, before the papers were finally stamped and baggage clumsily repacked, and Hall could climb aboard the southbound Finnish train. The line was once again a single track. Progress was slow and dirty, for since the war began, the engines on this route had run on wood rather than coal. Clouds of ash blew through any window that was left open. Grey smoke and steam concealed the view of Finland's famous lakes. The days were growing longer fast, but it was dark when his train finally arrived at the border station of Belovstrov. Here, crossing into Russia proper, from its province of Finland, he faced another round of paper checking and incomprehensible commands. As crumpled and bewildered as a peasant, he reached Petrograd's main northern terminus, the Finland station, at midnight. The platforms and arrival hall were barely lit and almost deserted. There was a moment of exhausted panic before he made out a familiar British uniform. It was the official driver, at last. In minutes, and with all his luggage safely stowed, Samuel Hall was settled in the car, secure again, after his short brush with barbarity. It did not take long to speed through the working-class district behind the station. Crossing the river, wide and still half-frozen, Hoare headed for the palace quarter and a hotel bed. A diplomat was wisest to avoid the streets where ordinary people lived and worked. It was a lesson he would learn in the coming days, along with the rules of court etiquette and the problems of finding a reliable maid. The MP had arrived in Petrograd, and he was about to begin his work for the new, secret, and very indefinite British Intelligence Service. In 1916, Petrograd had a population of more than 2 million, swelled, since the war began, by huddled lines of migrant workers and refugees. Built on the Neva River Delta, the city lent itself to social subdivisions. The poor tended to live in the factory quarters that had sprung up round the vast new metalworking and armaments works. The streets behind the Finland station led to narrow yards and blind windows, for this was the Viborg district, home to the Ericsson metal and machine works, the Nobel and New Lesner factories, both specialising in weapons and explosives, the old Samson spinning and weaving factory, and several large steel mills. South of the river, to the east, the Akta district boasted a state-run explosives plant and a gunpowder factory, while to the southwest loomed the massive Putilov works, employing a workforce of tens of thousands and turning out rail track and rolling stock, as well as artillery. Manufacturing had been a gold mine for speculators in the years before the war, but housing for the men and women it employed had seemed a less attractive investment. Whatever the hardships, however, recruits continued to flock from the villages in search of work. The other citizens of Petrograd, the types who kept a carriage and took boxes at the theatre, settled on the south edge of Vasilevsky Island, along the waterfront of the Petrograd side and in the better districts near the Winter Palace. Tall houses by the city's network of canals afforded spacious first-floor flats for wealthy clients, although the basements and attics were available at lower rents for anyone from tradespeople to failing writers. In general, however, the main contact that moneyed people had with the city's grittier side was through their servants, drivers and doormen. The magnificent Nevsky Prospect, Petrograd's main street, was a place where the poor and unenfranchised seldom stepped. At times of stress, and there had been a revolution in 1905, the city governor could order that the bridges should be raised, turning the Neva into a huge moat and blocking access from almost all the most notorious suburbs. It was a pity that there had to be a mainline railway station near Nevsky Prospect, and it was unfortunate that factories were visible behind the palaces. But troublemakers could always be packed into the cells of prisons, like the Peter Paul Fortress and Kresty, both of them landmarks on a dazzling waterfront. The British Embassy occupied a large part of Soltikov Palace, a building otherwise known as No. 4 Palace Embankment. The location was magnificent, just a short walk along the river from the Winter Palace, and commanding views across the water to the Peter Paul Fortress and its golden spire. The embassy was an enormous building, spacious and solidly comfortable, though not in the least beautiful, the ambassador's daughter, Meriel Buchanan, would later write. Its most remarkable features were the grand staircase and the ballroom, both of which had windows facing the river. But the offices were inconvenient, and the building was shared with an ancient princess, Anna Sergeyevna Soltikova, who still lived in the back with her servants and a loquacious geriatric parrot. Hoare would soon need to meet his own men, but the diplomatic part of his mission, the interdepartmental peacemaking, demanded that he pay an early call on the ambassador. Sir George Buchanan had been London's man in Russia since 1910, and had built a reputation as Petrograd's most reliable and experienced diplomat. Hoare would soon fall under his spell. "If I had to draw a picture of a British ambassador," recalled the spy, "I should have drawn Sir George Buchanan. Distinguished, detached, rather shy in manner, and good-looking, in the style that was most admired 20 years before." Robert Bruce Lockhart, who supported Sir George from an office in Moscow, agreed, observing that his monocle, his finely chiselled features, and his beautiful silver-grey hair gave him something of the appearance of a stage diplomat. In Ashendon, the collection of stories that he based on his own wartime spy missions, Somerset Maugham turned Sir George into Sir Herbert Witherspoon and had him presiding over dinner like a baronet in one of England's grandest country houses. A less kindly visitor, however, remembered a frigidity that would have sent a shiver down the spine of a polar bear. Buchanan's view of spies might have been dim, but he was determined that Russia should go on fighting for an Allied victory in the Great War. To ensure that it did, he was prepared to sup with almost any devil London sent, and Hoare became a regular guest at the embassy. He was entertained by Lady Georgina, the ambassador's wife, by his daughter, Meriel, and by at least one bad-tempered Siamese cat. Hoare also dined with some of Europe's diplomatic stars, including Maurice Palaiologue, the French ambassador, and the Marquis André Colletti di Rapabella from Italy. The man from the United States, David Francis, preferred his poker to Buchanan's linen and claret, but that still left an assortment of interesting British staff for Hoare to meet. The place to find them was the Chancery Department on the first landing of the embassy stairs. There, young men in their worsted suits devoted the best hours of every day to typing, encoding, and deciphering reports. No Russian secretary was on hand, for secrecy was paramount, even between allies. "My impression," Lockhart recalled, "was of a typing and telegraph bureau conducted by old Etonians." Hoare's own office was a brisk walk west along Palace Embankment. You turned left at the Winter Palace, a vast ensemble of 1,500 rooms whose stucco had been painted in a melancholy oxblood red. Behind it, across Palace Square, stretched the parade of well-matched buildings also painted like beefsteak that housed the main government departments, including the military general staff. Here, crammed into some upper rooms, was the office of British military intelligence, an afterthought to that of France, which was next door. It might have been convenient, but it was not a place Hoare grew to love. "True to Russian type," he complained, "the facade was the best part of the building. At the back of the general staff was a network of smelly yards and muddy passages that made entrance difficult and health precarious." But Hoare was not in town to admire the Rastrelli palaces. As he set to work in that stuffy room, he had to come to terms with Russia's extraordinary foreigners. Despite his straight-laced English background, the sheer amount of ceremony in the capital oppressed him. It was a good thing that the Swedes had never found his sword, for now he was expected to wear it at work. Another unwelcome surprise was the discovery that the Russians did not have a unified secret service of their own that he could work beside. The general staff, the head of each army group, and the Ministry of Marine each had their own intelligence agents, but the competition between them was so fierce that none could spare much energy for him. A more efficient network was operated by the Interior Ministry, and another by the Holy Synod, but neither was prepared to share its information with a foreigner. "No one else was fighting the war as we were fighting it," the disappointed Englishman observed. "The people in London projected Whitehall into the square of the Winter Palace." But Russia's war effort was as chaotic as it was unpopular. He might have learned more if he'd been more attentive to the staff already working in that cramped room over the Moika Canal. The acting head of intelligence at the time was Major Cuthbert Thornhill, an old India hand, and a good shot with rifle, catapult, shotgun, and blowpipe. In the summer of 1916, however, when Hoare took over the British Secret Intelligence mission himself, Thornhill was moved into the role of assistant military attaché. The transfer left a small and dedicated staff for Hoare, theoretically, to command. Lieutenants Stephen Alley and Oswald Rayner were both fluent Russian speakers with good contacts in the capital. Captain Leo Steveni, who worked with Thornhill, helped collect battle intelligence, including information about German naval strategy. Clashes with the military attaché, Colonel Alfred Knox, were inescapable from the first. In one embassy official's view, after all, Knox constituted Britain's real link with the country. It was an opinion that Knox himself fully endorsed, and he always behaved as if he knew Russia better than the rest of the British colony put together. As an Ulsterman, however, he was deemed to come from the wrong class, so he could not be assigned to the Tsar's military headquarters, the Stavka, a job reserved for an incompetent called Sir John Hanbury Williams. The tension could be almost tangible. But all the same, this group of men had been able to set their differences apart for long enough to gather a good deal of vital information in the months before Hoare arrived, including, Steveni later affirmed, the intelligence that had enabled British ships to intercept part of the German high seas fleet off Dogger Bank in 1915. As Hoare was to discover, the rest of the British colony in Petrograd had all the markings of an Oxford college inadvertently displaced. There was a scattering of academics and a more voluble cluster of writers, many of whom were earning their keep by sending columns to the British press. Arthur Ransom was one of these, but the most colourful was Harold Williams, a linguist, essayist, and correspondent for three newspapers, who had married a prominent liberal activist. Through his wife, Ariadna Tyrkova, "a woman of advanced views," pronounced Buchanan, Williams knew almost every political figure in Petrograd. "He was a very quiet man," Arthur Ransom remembered, "and extraordinarily kind. I do not think it possible that he can ever have had an enemy. If Knox was the embassy's link with the country, and especially with the army, Williams connected it to Petrograd's emerging political class, the critics and reformers, who yearned to introduce a modern constitutional government. It was not long before the gloom began to get to him. While Ali and his friends continued with their secret work, Hall was approached by a representative of the Orthodox Church, who wanted him to help resolve a candle wax shortage. Before the wartime trade blockade, a German firm called Stumpf had supplied 13.5 tons of the stuff to Russia's churches every year. The politicians might have cut the supply, but the faithful still needed to light their prayers. The blockade, and indirectly Britain, was also blamed for other kinds of darkness in day-to-day Russian life. In time, Hoare arranged for wax imports to come in through the port of Archangel, but he could not brighten up a whole society. Petrograd's theatres were half empty, the shops were grey, and conversation focused on bad news and worse prospects. Most of the men and women who had made the Russian capital so brilliant in pre-war days were at the front, Hoare remarked, and for those whose households and fortunes were limited, entertaining had become almost impossible. He had problems enough himself, for rents had soared in recent months. Even Sir George Buchanan was worried by the fact that several of his staff, including married ones with families, had taken hotel rooms because they could not keep up the inflated payments of their erstwhile homes. The prices of basic commodities had risen so fast that diplomatic salaries were stretched. In September 1916, Maurice Paleologue observed in his diary that wood and eggs now cost four times what they had done 2 years before, and butter five times more. How Russian workers were supposed to cope remained a mystery. The long queues, Hall observed grey women outside food shops, had become a fixture by 1916. So hostile was the general mood that there were rumours that the anti-war feeling in the crowds was being fanned by German agents. Everyone had to make do. Hoare employed an English servant, who worked for him every day. But the man kept two changes of livery handy, so that he could help out on alternate nights at functions for the British and French embassies. All countries suffered in the war, of course. But Russia seemed to suffer most. While London imagined that the difficulties could be solved by sending extra guns and offering a bit more credit to the Russian bourse, it did not take anyone in Petrograd long to see that goodwill and imports were not enough. Nothing was working as it should, from transport to the army general staff, and from the Russian police to the delivery of coal supplies. The political machinery had completely stalled, sabotaged by the Tsar, his empress, and what some now saw as a complex German plot to undermine Russia itself. "There is no directing will," observed one leading politician from the time. "No plan, no system. And there could not be any. The supreme authority was imprisoned by harmful influences." Hoare would have got the story from the clubbable liberals and wealthy industrialists who made up Russia's political class. Where his ambassador was too fastidious to interfere, he met these through Harold Williams, who knew everyone from Mikhail Rozhyanko, the chairman of the Russian parliament, the Duma, to reformers like Paul Milyukov and Alexander Guchkov. All told the same basic tale. Russia was heading for disaster like a car speeding towards a cliff. It might have needed two brandies to get any Russian to say it openly, but the fundamental problem was the Tsar. Since he had taken personal command of the army in August 1915, spending more and more time at his headquarters near the front, Nicholas II had lost whatever knack he ever had for leadership. He ignored or actively spurned the Duma while stuffing the upper house, the Council of Ministers, with people so talentless that they were almost comical. Hoare knew about the council at first hand, having recently attended a reception in his chambers at the Marinsky Palace. The place had smelled of mothballs and despair, and he'd been cornered over tea by an official who was so deaf that he mistook the British officer for a German and began loudly to denounce English perfidy and English democratic ways. The catalogue of Nicholas's errors was growing fast. In January 1916, the Tsar had dismissed his 76-year-old Premier, Ivan Goromykin. But Goromykin's replacement, Boris Stürmer, was almost as reactionary and even less effectual. No one liked Stürmer, including Harold Williams, who threw down a gauntlet with the remark that a more corrupt, cynical, incompetent and lying functionary it would be hard to find in the Russian Empire. He was totally ignorant of everything undertook, remembered Paul Milyukov. Untroubled by this opposition, or by the suspicion that the German sound of Stürmer's name inevitably roused, the Tsar added the foreign and interior ministries to Stürmer's portfolio in the summer of 1916. The only qualification the man appeared to have for any of these vital tasks was his experience of fawning on the imperial family during their tour of Russia for the Romanovs' tercentenary a few years earlier. The Duma met at the other end of town, in the notoriously drafty Tauride Palace. Created as a concession after the upheavals of 1905, it still felt like the dress rehearsal for a parliament. A portrait of the Tsar stared over its chamber, showing him on a trip to Italy, not even Russia, and apparently smirking in contempt at the vulgar notion of democracy. Hoare found the Duma's members obviously disillusioned and embittered by the hopelessness of their situation. They took their politics very seriously, but the Tsar prorogued their house whenever he detected challenge or dissent. The last round of elections, held in 1912, had returned a few Marxists, mainly members of the Menshevik Party, but most of these had promptly been arrested or exiled. Apart from them, the only real radicals were members of the Cadet Party, all devoted to reform, but none so wild that he would not sit on a committee. "Ours was a party of lawyers, doctors and professors," remembered Paul Milyukov, one of the most distinguished of the cadets. His views, according to Professor Bernard Pears, an academic who had come to town as C's nephew to do a little spying on the side, "never seemed to me to diverge much from what one could hear at any time in the National Liberal Club in London." Milyukov's aim was to steer Russia into constitutional monarchy. In 1916 Petrograd, that made him a red firebrand. The Duma's list of demands had grown during the war. In 1915, a group of its members, including the cadets, had formed a progressive bloc to defend Russia's military honour and its people's fragile constitutional rights. On the left wing of the coalition, Milyukov believed that Russia could not continue to force its rule on subject nations like the Balts and Poles. Autonomy and equal rights, rather than full independence, might offer an acceptable compromise, while inside Russia there should be an end to discrimination against religious minorities, including Jews. Other cadets were keen to talk about trade unions and labour rights, a political amnesty, and an end to the censorship by which even speeches in the Duma were not always reported. As a whole, however, the bloc was there to win the war and foster trade, courting the European markets and proposing smoother regulations of a system that was choking on red tape. It was to promote his country's industry and commerce that Milyukov, who had always taken a special interest in the Balkans, came to advocate Russian control of Constantinople and the straits that connected the Black Sea to the Mediterranean. His hopes in that direction inspired an obsessive commitment to the war. But Milyukov knew all too well that victory came at a price. A year before, his younger son had died in fighting on the Austrian front. It was not liberal reform, however, and it was not even the army's terrible record of casualties that Petrograd was talking about as the first snow blew lightly on the Neva in the autumn of 1916. The city was gripped by the fear of what were simply called dark forces. The Germans, it was whispered, had a foothold at court. Their goal was to persuade Russia to withdraw from the war. If that happened, Berlin could focus all its troops along a single front, crushing the French and British like so many gnats. The enticements for Russia included an end to the heartbreaking deaths, but extreme right-wingers also hoped that Prussian officers, as paragons of discipline and hierarchy, might help them to restore a fitting and reactionary government. The talks went on quietly, sometimes in Stockholm or in Copenhagen. A British businessman called Stinton Jones suggested that the game was darker than Russians themselves could see. The plotters, he explained, would engineer a popular revolt to make Russia seem ungovernable. As planned, the emergency would serve as an excuse to sign a separate peace with Germany. Thereafter, however, Russia would become a nation despicable in the eyes of the world, and when the time arrived for Germany to rend Russia, there would be none to help her. So Germany would progress a step further in her scheme of world domination. The trail of rumour led directly to the Empress. Alexandra had been born with a different title, Alix of Hesse and by Rhine, and many believed that she remained Germany's agent. Sir George Buchanan dismissed the idea. "She is not," he wrote in February 1917, "a German working in Germany's interests, but a reactionary who wishes to hand down the autocracy intact to her son." Her interference in ministerial appointments, however, had turned her into what Buchanan called the unconscious tool of others who really are German agents. Liberal critics believed that she was behind Stürmer's appointment, for nothing else could explain it. When the ingratiating Alexander Protopopov, another of Alexandra's favourites, was appointed to the Interior Ministry in September 1916, suspicion seemed to be confirmed. Protopopov, who was rumoured to be insane, he suffered from a degenerative nervous disorder linked to advanced syphilis, had been spotted talking to a German agent on a recent visit to Stockholm. In reality, Protopopov was more likely to see a vision of the crucifixion than to hatch a plot. But there were other agents of the Kaiser in the Empress Alexandra's suite. Maurice Palaiologue believed the shadowy movement to include representatives of the Holy Synod, members of the Baltic nobility, big financiers and pro-German industrialists. "The predominant motive," he wrote, "is fear. The fear to which the reactionary party is inspired on seeing Russia in so close and prolonged an association with the democratic powers of the West." In October, the French ambassador spent an evening with a court functionary, who gave him more details of the cabal that was snaking its way about the court. "That gang will stop at nothing," he warned. "They'll foment strikes, riots, pogroms. They'll try to produce social distress and famine and make everyone so thoroughly wretched and despondent that the continuation of the war will become impossible." The informant had been so terrified that he had refused to confide in Palaiologue at all until the servants had gone home. The spies seemed to be everywhere. It was almost a reflex to blame the Jews, a prejudice that the British indulged at least as often as the Russians. As George Buchanan put it, "Jews, as a class, are pro-German, and rumours aimed at spreading dissatisfaction or mistrust in Russia herself and in her allies are traceable to them." There was nothing else about the continual plotting that was routine. As Samuel Hoare reported to military intelligence in December 1916, "The outstanding feature, unique in the history of Russia, is that all sections of society are united against the small group, half-court, half-bureaucracy, that is attempting to keep the complete control of government in its hands." "A palace coup was openly spoken of," Buchanan recollected. "And at dinner at the embassy, a Russian friend of mine declared that it was a mere question whether both the emperor and empress, or only the latter, would be killed." Buchanan's sole priority was keeping Russia in the war. Every move in the critical weeks ahead was judged by what it meant for the next spring's campaign. every new minister or public strike assessed in terms of military morale. And the picture was changing very fast indeed. First came the Duma's new session, which opened on the 1st of November 1916. The mood was tense already, but the opening speeches would have been sensational at any time. Although it could not be reported, the newspapers and protests carried blank spaces where the word should have been, Milyukov's attack on the Tsarist administration was soon being quoted everywhere. He had listed the many misdeeds of the past few months, pausing after each to ask, with theatrical repetition, whether the House considered it to be a case of stupidity or treason. The answer was damning. The consequences are the same, concluded Milyukov. And the speech led to Stürmer's dismissal. As the Imperial Secret Police, the Okhrana reported grudgingly, the hero of the hour is Milyukov. Heroics in the Duma notwithstanding, the mass of the population was struggling, increasingly resentful of both government and war. The winter of 1916-17 was hungrier than any since the war began. Factory workers, forced to queue for basic goods and work in bitter cold, grew anxious and then angry, blaming the Empress and the war. At a time of inflation, some found their wages dwindling, as the labour force was augmented with unskilled women from the villages, a group who did not think of bargaining as cadre workers had. Although a striker could face deportation to the front, or years of hard labour in penal camps, the number of strikes increased as prices rose, and many included direct political demands. In October, during a strike at the Renault works, some of the troops who had been called to disperse the protesters changed sides and fired on their officers. The atmosphere was so poisonous that many cavalry officers, reluctant to shoot their own people, began asking to be sent to the front to avoid a posting in the Petrograd garrison. On Boxing Day 1916, Hoare cabled a sombre message back to London. It is probably correct to say that a very great majority of the civilian population of Russia is in favour of peace, it read. The conditions of life have become so intolerable, the Russian casualties have been so heavy, the ages and classes subject to military service have been so widely extended, the disorganisation and untrustworthiness of the government have become so notorious, that it is not a matter of surprise if the majority of ordinary people reach at any peace straw. His last sentence was conveyed with special emphasis. Personally, I am convinced that Russia will never fight through another winter. Within a week, however, these thoughts were interrupted by the murder of a notorious monk. Rasputin shared the public's hatred more or less equally with his patron and admirer, the Empress Alexandra. He was widely believed to sympathise with the German cause, to favour tyranny, and to have allowed German agents to get close to the Empress. He was also dissolute, dirty, manipulative, and rude. His murder at the hands of a small group of titled patriots, therefore, was enough to divert attention from almost any hardship of the New Year holiday. Hoare prefaced his own 10-page report with a disclaimer. If it is written in the style of the Daily Mail, he began, my answer is that the whole question is so sensational that one cannot describe it as one would if it were an ordinary episode of the war. These things would not have happened to a clergyman in Chelsea, certainly. At first light on the first day of 1917, the Petrograd police had found a man's overshoe, in a large size, in snow on the bank of a branch of the Neva. The trail led them to search the frozen river, and thence to the discovery of a mutilated corpse. As it was hacked out of the ice, the body, huge and difficult to move, was unmistakably Rasputin's. He had been poisoned with cyanide, beaten, and shot with at least two guns before his body had been bound in heavy chains and pushed under the ice. A devastated Alexandra went into mourning as soon as she was told the news. The rest of Petrograd, by all accounts, was delighted. There was great rejoicing among the public when it heard of the death of Rasputin, wrote Palaiolog, People kissed each other in the street, and many went to burn candles in Our Lady of Kazan. If one cannot say good about the deed, reported Hoare, one can at least say about the death nothing but good. What Hoare seemed not to want to say was that his own men may have helped to plan and execute the crime. It could even have been Oswald Rayner who fired the fatal shot, killing Rasputin after torturing him for hours to find out what he knew of German influence within the Tsarist court. A cover story was prepared, and the murder came to be seen as a purely Russian patriotic act. But even Hoare had noticed recently that members of his team had started using the word liquidate with an alarming frequency. As Hoare conceded, the murder showed what could be done, though what it had achieved was questionable. The capital soon returned to its accustomed mode of bleak despair. In an act of pure spite, an unrepentant clutch of ministers outlawed a conference of local government and charitable organizations that had been planned for the new year. A round of elections to Moscow City Council was blatantly rigged. Visiting Petrograd in January 1917, Robert Bruce Lockhart found the atmosphere more depressing than ever. Champagne flowed like water. The Astoria and the Europe, the two best hotels in the capital, were thronged with officers who should have been at the front. Even in the embassy, hope had sunk to a low ebb. Sir George himself looked tired and ill. After a struggle with his conscience and the regulations, Buchanan broke with protocol and tried to warn the Tsar. On the 12th of January, the Russian New Year, he called at the palace at Tsarko Selo. Perhaps anticipating some bad news, the Tsar received him without the customary warmth. Both men remained standing as Sir George said his piece. "I explained," he wrote, "that the coordination of our efforts would not suffice unless there was in each of the Allied countries complete solidarity between all classes of the population." Nicholas heard him out, said almost nothing in reply, and dismissed his visitor before he let himself give way to angry trembling. The Empress may have hurried to console him, for Palaiolog learned that she had been listening to everything through a half-open door. Russia remained an ally, however, and allies always had to talk. Back in December, the British, French and Italian general staffs had met at Chantilly to plan the new season's campaigns. The logistics of the journey had kept the Russians away, so it was agreed that a delegation from all three Western powers should travel to Petrograd for talks. Lord Kitchener, the Secretary of State of War, would normally have run the show, and had set out to visit Russia the summer before. But he was killed on the way when his armoured cruiser hit a mine off Scarpa Flow. His leadership was missed, as a team assembled under Lord Milner and General de Castelnau, neither of whom knew Russia at all. What Hoare would call the Allied Noah's Ark set out by sea for the port of Romanov, now Murmansk, in January 1917. Passing safely through the submarines, the members of the delegation were among the first to trundle down the Murman Railway to Petrograd, a journey that required 4 days. Lockhart despaired. "Rarely in the history of great wars," he wrote, "can so many important ministers and generals have left their respective countries on so useless an errand." To avoid the possibility that Milner's mission might do harm, Hoare wrote, "the Russians decided to prevent it from doing anything at all, a tactic that involved a succession of dinners, lunches, concerts, and dances. Court carriages with beautifully groomed horses and the crimson and gold of the imperial liveries passed up and down the streets," Meriel Buchanan recalled. "An endless stream of motors stood at all hours of the day before the Hotel d'Europe, where the missions had been lodged. Hoare persuaded the governor of Petrograd to permit a restaurant called the Bear to stay open all night, so that the delegates might entertain their favourite stars from the ballet and opera. The Russians were prepared to keep up their hospitality as long as the vodka and caviar lasted." Though talks took place about finance, supplies, and plans for the next spring's campaign, Lord Milner did not think much was achieved. The parties were too large, the noise too loud, and every meeting room was watched by far too many spies. In February, they were gone. Their leaving was so secret that the delegates were asked to sacrifice their shoes, leaving the pairs as usual outside their hotel rooms so that the staff, or German assassins, would think the occupants still there. Perhaps conceding that events had overtaken him, Sir Samuel Hoare had also packed his bags. He claimed to have put the spy mission on its feet. It had a staff of 17 by the time he left, but yet again he decided to invoke his own ill health to get him out of an uncomfortable fix. He joined the Milner delegation on the train, heading for Port Romanoff and a British warship named Kildonan Castle. The journey home was sobering. The nights were haunted by phantom explosions, and many of the travellers chose to distract themselves by preparing reports. By the time Orkney's cliffs came into view, most of them had completed at least one draft. On the 6th of March, Lord Milner told the British cabinet that the Russians were, in fact, Orientals to a large extent, very suspicious and sometimes stuffy, but willing to be led by capable leadership. That leadership might be a problem. But as Milner had assured Lockhart, the general consensus of informed opinion, both Allied and Russian, as far as I can gather, is that there will be no revolution until after the war. For Meriel Buchanan, who had remained in Petrograd, it seemed as if the frost set hard after the mission left. Without the distraction and the champagne, there was no avoiding the evidence of social tension. It was said that Protopopov, perhaps after one of his religious visions, had ordered that machine guns should be placed on the roofs of the city's large buildings in readiness for popular unrest. The queues were growing longer, and the number of strikes seemed to increase from week to week. 243 political strikes had been recorded in Russian cities in 1916, but the number exceeded 1,000 in the months of January and February 1917 alone. From Moscow, Lockhart reported that a large factory producing hand grenades had found its orders cancelled nominally on the ground that no more hand grenades were required, but in reality, because the government were afraid of allowing the public organisations to have any control of such dangerous articles for revolution as hand grenades. For now, however, the bitter cold, exceptional even for Russia, seemed to have paralysed all life. With the mercury at 38 degrees below, no one was throwing anything. In balmy London, as the daffodils began to bud, the MP, Major David Davies, another member of the Milner team, delivered his report to the British cabinet. "It is not believed," Davies declared, "that a popular rising would have any chance of success. What may happen is a palace revolution, ending in the removal of the Emperor and Empress. Russia's war effort would not be harmed, for it was probable that a fait accompli would be accepted quietly by the country. That meant that the Allies would win." What mattered now was the next step. As Davies warned, after the war, there is no doubt that the Germans will make strenuous efforts to regain the ascendancy in Russian trade, which they have temporarily lost, and it will be our business to make provisions in time for the development of our own trade, and to exercise sufficient influence over the internal affairs of the country. The progress of the world, in a large measure, depends upon the planting of British ideas on Russian soil.